Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Got another 2 hours this Sunday afternoon, and I want to encourage you to join in. It's really easy to do. Just pick up the phone, dial 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. I'm always anxious to talk to people listening in, whether you agree or disagree. In fact, sometimes if you disagree, it's even better. So do not be afraid to call in and let your voice be heard. I have a lot to talk about over the next 2 hours. I want to again thank Nancy Skinner. I really enjoy our discussions, particularly actually when we disagree. I think sometimes when we disagree, it makes for even more interesting discussion than when we agree. I enjoy my chocolate and her peanut butter for the last hour of her show, and her peanut butter and my chocolate for the first hour of the Inside Scoop. I have a lot to talk about here in the next 2 hours. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to have Janessa Goldbeck on. Now, Janessa is really, I think, the epitome of what We Act Radio is about. This is a person who is acting, and acting in an extraordinary way. Janessa took a bike trip across the United States, and she went in the southern states, the red states. She started in the Southwest. I think she started in California. I'll ask her. Went through Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, all the South, arguing something that you think would be impossible in the red states to argue. Argue that we need more money for international development, which is a huge bunch of words that goes basically helping aid people in trouble all over the world, whether it's Africa or Asia or the Middle East, helping to feed people, helping to cure diseases. Really, it's kind of like the Peace Corps. And she's going around getting support for it in the red states, in a tough economy. You think about a hard task. And yet, according to Janessa, it really isn't that hard at all, which I find amazing. So we're going to have her basically sharing her story. She's coming on in about 10 minutes or so. But then I want to move on based on what she has to say and talk a little bit more about the Arab Spring, because it's fascinating where it's going. I have been very critical of President Obama on the Arab Spring. I am not someone, if you listen to my show, that says, oh, Obama's perfect, he's wonderful. Yes, of course I support President Obama over Mitt Romney. It would be a disaster if Mitt Romney were to be elected. But I also think it's important, frankly, that you don't just say I'm 100% for one candidate or another, because to me, if you 100% agree with someone, you're not a very discriminating individual. You haven't put a lot of thought into your positions. And I try to put a lot of thought into my positions, and I agree with Obama on a lot of things. But when it comes to the Arab Spring, I think we're going in the wrong direction. I particularly am concerned about Syria. You know, if you've listened to my show, I have brought in people calling, risking their lives to call from Syria, people with the Syrian Free Army. And in Syria, we are seeing really fears of al-Qaeda, fears of terrorism. Look at all the trillions of dollars we have spent in Afghanistan trying to fight al-Qaeda because it attacked the United States. The idea that al-Qaeda could get a foothold in Syria and we spend another $1 trillion there, when there are independent, democratic, free people in Syria that don't support al-Qaeda but hate their government. See, people don't understand a lot of times where terrorism comes from. Republicans say, oh, al-Qaeda just wants to, you know, create a Muslim caliphate and destroy the United States of America. That may well be true of Osama bin Laden and a few people at the very top. But the mass followers, frankly, the suicide bombers, the poor schnooks who are stupid enough, believing enough, crazy enough to strap these bombs on and enter planes and so forth, they're not the leaders of the movement. The leaders don't strap bombs on themselves. They are people who are influenced to follow them. And they're usually doing that because in their own countries there's a lot of misery. There's a lot of economic hardship. There's a lot of trouble. And that trouble is almost never caused by the United States. Sorry, all you leftists out there. The trouble is caused by the countries themselves and having dictators. Throughout the Arab world, it's one dictator after another, one right after another. And to me, the beauty of the Arab Spring, the glory of the Arab Spring, is that what it showed people throughout the Middle East is you can rise up against a corrupt leadership and do so without terrorism, without al-Qaeda, without violence, without blowing up innocent people. You just march in the streets and you can create change. And frankly, if you want to know the biggest blow to al-Qaeda ever, all right, killing Osama bin Laden, that was a big blow. I would argue that the Arab Spring is a bigger blow, even than killing Osama bin Laden, because people are looking for a way out. And they see no way out when it comes to these corrupt dictatorships. Remember how the Arab Spring began. A fruit seller in Tunisia was trying to sell his fruit in a small town in Tunisia. Think about this. Bouazizi was just a young guy struggling to eat and to sell his fruit. And some bureaucrat in Tunisia said, you can't sell your fruit here on this stand. And he'd been turned down by time and time again. Finally, they stole his fruit cart. And the poor guy lit himself on fire to illustrate his extreme frustration with the kind of red tape and bureaucracy and corruption that was endemic, not just in Tunisia, but throughout the Arab world. And that flame ignited a roaring fire. And we've seen it, right? Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, Bahrain. The list goes on and on and on. Iran, in fact, had it even before the Tunisian fruit seller. But what the Arab Spring shows is that people can act and take charge in their own ways. And they can do so through social media, Facebook, Twitter. Once people realize that, other people feel the same way. And the way I see it, the Arab Spring is an avalanche. It began with a few pebbles coming down a mountain, and then it became some rocks, and now it is a roaring bunch of avalanche coming down the mountain. And those who think that we can stand in there and stop the boulders are just crazy. There are people that say, well, President Obama, you should never have allowed the Egyptian Arab Spring to succeed because Mubarak was the devil we know, and we don't know the next devil in Egypt. And I argue with Republicans all the time on this point. And I am worried about Egypt. Don't get me wrong. They are having an election. It's going to come May 23rd, I believe, so it's around the corner. It's coming in a couple weeks. And they're going to have a choice between a presidential candidate, Musa, who is was the foreign minister under Mubarak. And frankly, I kind of hope he wins, even though he represents the old school, because the other guy, Fotu, he's someone who would bring in the Muslim Brotherhood and probably end the peace treaty with Israel and really descend Egypt down to a place where the Coptic Christians are not protected. It seems to me that I don't like either candidate, but Musa is more likely to protect the minorities. We need to remember that when you have a democratic election, that's not enough. That's not enough to say you have a democratic government. A democratic election is just the start. And you can democratically elect dictators. Adolf Hitler was democratically elected. Let us never forget that. Hamas was democratically elected. Yeah, they haven't allowed elections since then. That's what dictators do. You elect them once and they stay in power. I am very concerned about what's going on in Egypt. But at the same time, to say that President Obama had to stand athwart history and stop the avalanche from coming down, had he defended Mubarak after all the people were in Tahrir Square and millions were marching and the guy was 18 days left in power, then the United States would have ended up with egg on their face, we would have been on the wrong side of history, and then I'm sure that the radicals in Egypt would have taken over. At least now there's a question of whether they're going to take over. I hope they don't. But they definitely would have taken over if Obama had stood up for Mubarak. I see the same thing happening in Syria, frankly. We did do the right thing in Libya. I'm proud to say I called for us to act in Libya before President Obama did. I called for us to go out there and to defend the people. And I want to make a clear distinction for those of you on the left. I did not support the war in Iraq. And I see a huge difference between Iraq and Libya. There's a big difference, in my humble opinion, between people who are trying to overthrow their own repressive regime and us aiding those people, fighting their battles, risking their lives on the ground, and aiding them with air support, and going in and invading a country and occupying it and taking it over. There's a reason why Iraq cost $1 trillion and Afghanistan cost $1 trillion and Libya cost a few billion. There's a reason why thousands of Americans lost their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan, tens of thousands wounded, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis in Afghanistan, and Afghanis lost their lives, millions were displaced. And in Libya, there have been some problems, but extremely, I don't think we lost a single American life. And the disruption to Libya has been far less great than in Iraq or Afghanistan. Because in Libya, as Colin Powell once famously said to George W. Bush, if you break it, you bought it. We broke Iraq, and we bought Iraq. We broke Afghanistan, and we bought Afghanistan. Libya, we didn't break it. It was already broken. Of course, so is, I guess, Afghanistan. It was already broken, but we came in. People were already working to fix it, and we helped them. And I want to be on the right side of history. And I am concerned. Right now, there are bombs in Syria. And it appears, and again, it's not like I know, but it appears that it may be Al-Qaeda that's doing these bombs. But whether it's Al-Qaeda or some other radical Islamist group, as people get desperate, they turn to desperate answers. The United Nations is being its typical feckless self. It's going in there and doing nothing. Frankly, I think Kofi Annan is making things worse by pretending there's some kind of peace plan when everyone knows that Assad isn't going to follow any of it. And the people are getting desperate. And I still think there's a window of opportunity for us to do the Libyan solution in Syria, for us to help the people fight their own battles. But if they can't trust us, and we know they can't trust Assad, then who are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to the same Islamic terrorists that we're fighting against. Again, Al-Qaeda doesn't exist because Osama bin Laden is a great thinker. Al-Qaeda exists because the people of Afghanistan were so desperate that they turned to anybody, including people like the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. Yes, Osama bin Laden would have existed without Afghanistan's troubles, but he wouldn't have been so powerful. And the same is true for the terrorist groups, whether they be in Syria or Yemen or Libya or anywhere else. We can do the same thing. We can do it for much, much cheaper, frankly. And more importantly, we can be on the right side of history. Let it be told 50 years from now, when people study the Arab Spring in history books, let it be told that the United States was on the right side of history. This goes back to my argument, frankly, with Nancy Skinner about marriage equality. I wanted President Obama to be on the right side of history. When it comes to foreign policy, I feel the same way. I want the United States to be on the right side of history. I want it to be told that when push came to shove, when people were fighting against repressive, genocidal dictators, America was on the people's side. You know, it was 20 years ago in Tiananmen Square when the people marched against the Chinese dictatorship. And we can't do anything there, obviously. China's way too powerful. But when that happened, they carried statues of liberty. America was always seen as the place people look to for liberty. And we already have a lot of people who don't like us in the Middle East. If we support more dictators, then we're not going to get a lot of American support. Let's face it, the same is true in Latin America, by the way. 10, 15 years ago, the whole battle, you may remember, over communism, right? In El Salvador and in Nicaragua and all the Guatemala. And you had this repressive dictators fighting against this communist insurgency. And the United States, you had the left tend to support the insurgency because the dictators were so bad. And the right, and the right supported the dictators because they were afraid of the communist insurgency. I say there's a third way. There is a democratic movement that does not support communism or terrorism or violence, but also doesn't support corrupt dictators. That third way is the Arab Spring, and we have to help flower that third way. We can do so through international development. We can do so through troops if we have to. And I don't mean troops on the ground. I mean air support. But it seems to me that if people have to choose between corrupt dictators and between terrorist insurgents, then we all lose. The people lose, and the whole world loses. And it's the role of the United States, as far as I'm concerned, to help flower that third way in between, and that's why I think we have to be on the right side of history in Syria. When we come back, I'm going to be speaking with Janessa Goldbeck. I want to get her views on what I just said, and specifically about the question of international development, whether the United States can help all over the world in both fighting corrupt dictatorships and at the same time helping build a democratic middle class that just wants to have a peaceful, responsive government and doesn't believe in putting one else down. It's a tough question, but I think Janessa can handle it. We'll be right back with Janessa and your calls, perhaps, if you want to join in. 202-889-9797 right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. We got a lot to talk about today. Everything from the Arab Spring to the Volcker Rule to the crazy Indiana Republicans, who unfortunately I think are typical of their party. But let's start with foreign policy, because I have on the line now Janessa Goldbeck. Now, Janessa is someone I met through the Truman National Security Project, which is a group of progressives that firmly believes that there is no contradiction between being a progressive and supporting national security, which is something I've always believed. And I realize that even among Truman, the idea of helping in Syria is controversial. But I've never chosen my views based entirely on anyone else's. I just call it as I see it. What Janessa has done is she has taken a bike trip. This is Iron Woman. All the way from, was it California, Janessa?
That's right.
All the way from what, L.A.? Is that where you started?
I started in San Francisco.
San Francisco. So from San Francisco, California, down through the red states, through the Southwest, which is awfully hot in this era of global warming, all the way through the South, arguing that we actually need more foreign aid. I don't know. It sounds like a death trip.
No, I expected to have to argue my case, to have to really push back on people that foreign aid is important to our national security. But what I found was actually that once you let people know how little we actually spend on international development, most people think it's like a quarter of our budget, but it's actually less than 1%. Once you let people know that number, most people, like, no matter if they're super hardcore right or hardcore left, they're like, oh, that's a very little number. It makes sense to spend a little bit to win friends, influence people, and keep problems small and far away.
What money are you advocating that we spend? What is the money? What is international development? That's two multi-syllable words. Where does the money actually go? Who does it go to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think international development is basically all of the work that we do abroad to mitigate problems, to make sure that things like disease, extremism, that they either are prevented or they remain small and away from our shores. So we're talking about, you know, we've got guys in Afghanistan, whether or not you believe in the war in Afghanistan or not, we have guys on the ground, men and women on the ground in uniform that are trying to build more secure towns. And part of that security is saying, hey, we're going to come in, we're going to provide for you, and we're going to make sure that you have schools and water, clean water. They turn around and the State Department and USAID, our main diplomatic and development agencies, are totally underfunded. They can't afford to provide those things. We're leaving our men and women in uniform sort of stranded out in the field and unable to achieve their mission. So international development can mean a lot of things. It can mean investing in, like I said, schools or health clinics. But it's basically providing things, helping people achieve opportunities so that they don't have to turn to groups like Hezbollah or Al-Shabaab for food aid, like we're seeing in the Horn of Africa right now, where hundreds of thousands of people are, you know, without access to food, and we're seeing extremist groups showing up and providing that and buying loyalty, in a sense.
Well,
like that's bad for us.
This dovetails nicely into the argument I was just making on the air, which is that when people have a choice between a corrupt dictatorship that doesn't provide for their people and a terrorist insurgency that might provide them with food aid, but meanwhile, while they're trying to overthrow the government, they're bombing civilians and doing awful things, or maybe they're communist, or maybe they have a religious bent where they don't believe in religious freedom. If their choice is between, you know, the Afghan government that existed or the Taliban, or in Central America between the dictatorships of Guatemala and El Salvador and the communist insurgency, or in the Arab Spring between, in Syria, between the corrupt, horrible, killing Syrian government and some Al-Qaeda insurgency, I don't know which side they're going to choose, but that's a choice between, let's face it, you know, fire, death by fire, or death by stoning. What you're suggesting, what international development does, is actually give people a third choice, right, between not supporting the corrupt dictator and not supporting the terrorist insurgency.
Yeah, people don't wake up every day and say, yo, I really want to be an extremist, like living in a cave, launching attacks on them. I mean, that is not a dream that people just inherently have. People want their kids to go to school. They want to have a better life for themselves and their family. And just like you and me, they're going to do everything in their power to get there. What international development does is just provide a way for America. You know, we are a country with a lot of influence, a lot of wealth, and we can spend a very little amount of money, and give people an opportunity to achieve a better life for themselves, so they're not forced to turn to these other groups that are, frankly, out to get us. You know, we build schools in America so that kids don't, you know, kids have an opportunity to pass the wealth. They don't have to go and join gangs. We should be investing in the rest of the world the same way, because we live in a global economy, global world where threats, you know, don't just stay overseas. They come to our shores, and we know that they will, so we need to be thinking in that way.
Janice, a lot of what you're describing suggests to me what the Peace Corps has done or continues to do. I always thought the Peace Corps was a fantastic program because it shows Americans arriving not with military uniforms on shooting, but arriving with civilian clothes on building bridges or schools or dams or things like that. Does a lot of this money go to the Peace Corps? Is that something that you're trying to encourage, more Peace Corps programs?
The Peace Corps is part of definitely our sort of international affairs effort. But what we're really talking about is funding for agencies like the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, the State Department. These are our two sort of primary agencies that are out there, either with diplomats or development programs, implementing the sorts of on-the-ground programs that help people achieve better lives in other places. So, these programs, like I said, are less than one. They cost less than 1% of our entire federal budget. It's a very, very small amount, and we're actually, what we've seen from the House this past week, in their budget proposal, they actually cut funding about 5% from last year's funding, which is really bad. So right now, sort of, you know, I've been talking to Americans as I go about how these programs are important to our national security, how they help keep us safe. And right now, more than ever, it's really important that people are calling their members of Congress and telling them that they need to fully fund USAID and the State Department.
And let us all remember that the cost of aiding, for example, the people of Afghanistan 15 years ago would have been maybe a few million, maybe even $1 billion. I doubt it even be that much. But the cost of dealing with Al-Qaeda, which murdered 3,000 Americans and sent us into a war there that still exists, that's been going on for more than 10 years now, that's more than $1 trillion. And, of course, thousands of American lives lost. So a lot of times this is the kind of thing, to me, it reminds me of a cancer. You can nip a cancer in the bud with chemotherapy or radiation treatment, and then that's it. You're done. No more cancer. If people are not so angry that they have to revolt, then you can fix the problem at its source. Whereas if you wait and it festers and some kind of terrorist movement grows, then you could be dealing with something that literally is dangerous to American lives, as was September 11th.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And I think that, you know, it's very easy to make a short-sighted argument. Oh, you know, let's just spend money here at home. Let's not spend money abroad because we deserve it. We're Americans. Well, you know, it's exactly like what you're saying, Mark. If you don't go get a cancer screening and you end up having to treat cancer, that's going to be way more expensive, way more painful down the line. So it isn't like an either-or, we spend it here or we spend it abroad. It's all about our security. It's all about our prosperity. And if we're not focusing on those things and thinking strategically, looking at the long road down the line, we're going to end up in a worse and more painful place. So we need to make sure that we're taking steps to prevent things from getting bad, getting big, and coming to our shores, and making the world a safer place for everybody.
Well, Janessa, let me ask you this, because I'm sure there are people out there that are saying, okay, all right, I'm convinced we have to stop the cancer in the bud before it gets bad. We need some international development because doing so prevents terrorist groups from growing and eventually affecting Americans. I get all that. But why us? Right? I mean, you must have heard this argument, Janessa. Canada's got money. Japan's got money. Saudi Arabia has tons of money, and they care about the Arabs and the Arab Spring. Europe certainly has some money. They're not doing so well right now. But in general, England and France, why is it always the United States? There are other Western nations who care about democratic values, who don't want terrorism. Why do we always have to bear the burden? How do you answer that question?
Well, interestingly, we don't always bear the burden. In fact, percentage-wise, we contribute less than a lot of other countries out there who have a lower GDP than us, that are quote-unquote less wealthy than the United States. So we actually are not necessarily meeting that commitment to the same level as other nations that are,
So your Europeans nations. Give more. Canada?
I will say beyond that, I am an American. I believe that our country is the most amazing country in the world. It's provided me with opportunities to do amazing things. I love being an American, and I think that everyone should have the opportunity to have the sort of dreams that when I was a kid, I was the American dream. That's a thing that we all know what it is. We all strive to achieve it. And, we could sit back and say, fine, let other countries take it. Let China go do all the international development work and make the world a safer place. Well, guess what? When China's doing that, China's buying goodwill for themselves. They're exporting the Chinese dream. They're exporting the Chinese dream
and
to
people
other
become beholden to China and thankful to China rather than thankful to the United States. And when China needs something from them,
We can make that call. We could say, like, fine, let the Chinese do it. Let the Chinese export the Chinese dream. I don't believe that. I think the American dream is better. I think the American dream is better, and we should be exporting that. We should give every person the opportunity to see what it is like to be an American, what that means. And we should be actively out there promoting that and giving people the opportunity to achieve it all over the world. And I would rather see the American dream achieved all over the world than the Chinese dream.
Janice, it's a very strong argument. I want to turn from your very strong argument, which obviously I support, to the question of activism. This is We Act Radio. We try to encourage people, if they believe something strongly, to make a difference, to go out and not just, you know, say what you believe, but literally go out and do something different. Now, you decided to take a bicycle tour from California, from San Francisco, all the way to Washington, D.C. It took you how long? How many months?
A little less than 3 months, yeah.
And other than having extremely strong thighs right now, I'm sure, what did you achieve? I get the goal, but what did you achieve by doing it in the way that you did it?
You know, what's really interesting about traveling by bicycle is that people really, you know, they want to talk to you. I'm a woman. I was traveling by myself. And so, you know, that I think a lot of women that I encountered on the road, they were very sort of shocked and kind of, you know, like, wow, that's scary. Like, people wanted to talk. It's a jumping off point. And a bicycle isn't political, right? It's a mode of transportation. It's a little odd. I had solar panels on my bike that I charged my iPhone. You know, so people always wanted to talk about that, and that was like a bridging factor. And I really believe that if you are someone who cares passionately about an issue, it's really important for you to find common ground with the people you're trying to convince.
But how
and
did you do that?
For me to, you know, go out there and just preach to the choir, but I wanted to go through states where foreign aid is not a popular concept. I wanted to talk to people who are not necessarily in the same political vein that I am. And
but Janice, I want you to help out.
A way to really start.
I want you to help out my listeners who have an idea like yours but are not quite sure how to implement it. So you're biking through, I don't know, Arizona or Utah, mm-hmm. or Texas, for that matter, which must have taken forever. And you're there, I don't know, near Waco, Texas or someplace. How do you get the conversation going? I mean, you're just a girl on a bike. I don't know what you had signs on your bike, International Development Now or something like that. But, I mean, how do you even begin the conversation so they realize you're not just a girl on a bike, but you're a young woman who's got this really important message? How do you even make that transition? How do you begin the conversation?
Well, my strategy was that I would go, whether I was like up at a gas station or in a small town, I would just go and sit in like the local hangout, whether that was a bar or a coffee shop, whatever. Even in a small town, there's always some place where people hang out. I would just go and just chill there, order a beer, order a cup of coffee, whatever, and wait for someone to talk. Someone would always approach me because I was clearly from out of town. And we'd start talking. And, you know, my big thing is always to establish a personal connection first before I jump onto the issue. And so we'd start talking, and they would be asking about my ride, and people would usually ask me, like, well, why did you decide to do this? And that's where really where I would start. But I think, like, you know, if you're someone who's planning on doing something, whether it's a bike trip or a rally or going even to a meeting where you're trying to influence people, it's really important to connect first. And, you know, I didn't want to be, you know, someone that was there for politics only. I wanted to understand what their town was about, what life was about in their town. I wanted to hear about that and then talk about it and talk about why these things are important to both of us. But really, really connecting first on a human level, sharing, you know, having a beer, having a cup of coffee, whatever. That's really important to do.
Janessa, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I know how Southerners, they're sort of the social mores of the South. And it's true that in the South, people will come up to you and talk to you and be very nice to you and sort of find out what you're doing. That doesn't necessarily mean that they believe in what you're doing. They're just a sort of a social politeness. How do you know that you're getting past just the, oh, who are you? You're from out of town. Nice to meet you. And actually persuading people. How do you know that you've made that pitch, that you've succeeded?
Well, it was pretty easy for me because I had a lot of logistical needs, right? So, like, if people offer you a place to stay or give you 20 bucks, like, to buy, you know, lunch and dinner in the next town or, you know, or anything like that. I found that people were so generous and just going above and beyond what I expected from strangers, obviously. You know, that was really an indicator, A, to me, that people were listening and kind of connecting with the message. But also, you know, I always ask people to do something. And, you know, the lowest bar ask for me is that you go visit makeusstrong.com, which is a website where this message of my campaign is really talked through in a lot more detail. There's a lot of videos and blog posts and cool stuff on there. So I'd always ask people to go do that. And then, you know, the second ask would be that they call their member of Congress, because I was meeting with elected officials my whole ride, and it was really important for me to be able to tell stories of interactions that I had with their constituents and how their constituents were supportive. So, you know, you always need to have, like, a hard ask, a tangible, whether that's sign a petition or give me your email address or whatever, and which I would really suggest for your listeners who are interested in making a difference in the world, have something tangible that people can do, but also, you know, the soft stuff, like, you know, people offering you a couch or
then you know they believe
wash
you.
Wash the grime off you.
Sure. Did you find that this strategy of going into the sort of commonplace in the town, and I guess you have to find it, I don't know, on the internet or whatever, but did that strategy of going in there and talking to people work better in small towns than it did in, say, Dallas or Birmingham or big cities where, you know, a stranger walks into a restaurant and you're not going to get questioned except maybe by the waitress?
Sure.
Is it harder in the big cities?
Yeah, definitely. And my strategy in bigger towns is I use a website called couchsurfing.org.
Called what? I'm sorry? I missed it.
It's called couchsurfing.org.
Couch?
It's basically a website for people who have, like, an extra couch or a
couch
room in their
surfing.
House. We'll host travelers for free. And what's that?
Couch surfing, like you're like on a surfboard.
Yeah, like surfboard. Couchsurfing.org.
Yeah. All right, go ahead.
I would highly recommend it. It's a really awesome service that, I mean, it's publicly reviewed. So if you stay with someone, they review you. Uh-huh. And you review them. So you can see people who have a lot of reviews.
And you get a free place to stay?
What's that?
You get a free place to stay?
Yeah, it's free. It's free.
Wow.
The ethos of it is very free. So I would highly suggest that. But that really plugged, like, when I was in Savannah, for instance, I used that, and I was immediately plugged into a local scene, you know, people who actually live there. So instead of, like, being at a motel and, like, going to, like, you know, the local Starbucks or whatever, I was hanging out with people who lived there, went to a barbecue at their house, met people. And that really just helps you kind of establish that kind of credibility. So I would really suggest, like, find, you know, if you're in a big town, like, you know, don't do the Motel 6. Like, find someone you can stay with, or can't even, like, can't, you know, go to a state park and camp, and, like, you'll meet people who live,
sure,
who are from the area. You know, put yourself out there. You gotta try to plug in if you want to change people's minds and talk to people who actually live in a town. You gotta jump into what life is like in that town.
Well, Janessa, you're an inspiration to activists all over, and certainly we at We Act Radio thank you for coming here on the Insights Group.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, that was terrific. I really appreciate it. I mean, Janessa, Gertrude, I think it was it Margaret Mead? No, it was Margaret Mead who said that never doubt that a small group of committed individuals can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And certainly Janessa exemplifies that kind of activism. When we come back, I want to talk more about the Arab Spring and then move on to the Volcker Rule and the craziness in Indiana. And, yeah, I got a few comments more to say about Obama and marriage equality. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Lot in the news today, and we are going to talk about President Obama and marriage equality, and definitely going on to the Volcker Rule and the craziness that's happening in Indiana. But I want to finish our talk on foreign policy here, because a lot of Americans aren't focused on what's going on in Syria and Egypt and Tunisia and Bahrain and the rest of the Arab Spring, just like we weren't focused much on Afghanistan before September 11th, 2001. And that lack of focus costs. You just heard Janessa Goldbeck talk about her really courageous trip across the country on bicycle from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., talking with people, telling them why we need international aid. I want to talk about the context of what I call this third choice. You see, right now in Syria, the people are between a rock and a hard place. Assad is a brutal, brutal dictator. This is Bashar Assad. His father, the dictator Hafez Assad, was so brutal that in 1982 he took Syria's fourth largest city, Hama, and when the people there revolted against his rule, he killed 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people. We don't know the numbers. We know it was in the tens of thousands. He literally razed the city to the ground. People talk about Iran has talked about taking Israel off the map. Well, Hafez Assad took Hama off the map, or at least the old city of Hama, which had existed for millennia, for thousands of years. It was an ancient city, and he literally turned it to dust, razed buildings, created a wilderness where a thriving city once was. This is a brutal, brutal dictator. His son is, I guess, trying to match his father in brutality. He's already killed at least 9,000, although that is certainly a minimum number. According to the activists in Syria who I talk with, there are 70 to 80,000 people that are missing. Maybe dead, maybe in mass graves, maybe just rounded up and put in prison camps where they're tortured. I'm one of the few radio hosts on the air, by the way, who has brought members of the Syrian Free Army right here on this network, calling, risking their lives from Syria to be on my show, and I'm going to bring them back. I'm not done with this issue. I will not be done with this issue until the killing stops. And I don't care that very few progressive or conservative radio hosts are talking about this. I'm talking about it because I care, and because I don't decide what I'm going to talk about based on what other people say. People are dying, and to me, the role of a human being is to stop mass death when you can. So what's going on in Syria right now? There was a massive suicide bombing in the capital of Damascus. Now, according to the Syrian Free Army, the government set up this attack, and they may very well have. The government has a lot to benefit from these suicide attacks. One, they can try to blame the Free Syrian Army for them and try to get people not to support them, not to support freedom in Syria. Number two, they can encourage international organizations and authorities, people like the United States, the United Nations, or other people who might arm the Free Syrian Army, that this is going to terrorist attacks, and therefore they shouldn't be armed, and therefore you should stay out of Syria's way and let Assad peacefully go about his task of massacring the Syrian people. But even if the government didn't do it, even if it was, as some suggest, what if it was Al-Qaeda? Great. Al-Qaeda getting a foothold in Syria. You just heard Janessa talk about how you can stop a malignant cancer with a little bit of radiation or chemotherapy, but if it grows and it spreads soon, you have no power to stop it. You can stop a pebble from rolling down a mountain, but you can't stop an avalanche. Syria is still at the pebble stage. Actually, it's more like some rocks. But we're not at boulders yet. We're not at an avalanche yet. We can still do for Syria what we did for Libya. Help the people help themselves. And the time to act is now, before Al-Qaeda gets a foothold. You see, doesn't matter to me who wins. If Assad wins and beats down and murders tens of thousands of people, and then Iran, who is the biggest danger in the Middle East, becomes even more powerful because they have this ally of Syria, and they can use Hezbollah and Hamas and fund those terrorist groups, and Iran's developing a nuclear weapon, and they can help the terrorist groups get a dirty bomb, and the people of Syria are in more trouble than they've ever been before, not to mention the people of Lebanon, which is occupied by Syria. That's if the government wins. if the government loses to an Al-Qaeda-like element, then we have Afghanistan, or for that matter, Yemen, as it is today, right? Or Somalia, a lawless place full of anarchy and civil war, where there's plenty of room for terrorists to get together and go to training camps, develop bombs like the more sophisticated underwear bomb that the Yemeni bomber is developing right now, the one that just came out, we heard about, is designed to avoid detection in airport facilities. And then we lead to another 9/11. So, damned if we do, damned if we don't, right? Damned if we allow this government to succeed, damned if we make this government fail through Al-Qaeda. No! It's not door number one or door number two. There is a door number three. That's the door that is closing. That is the door that we have to walk in before it closes. That's the door of Libya. That's the door of Bosnia. That's the door of supporting Christians in Syria and other minorities. That's the door of supporting students who are marching for freedom. That's the door of supporting the middle class. That's the door of supporting non-corrupt people who don't want their corrupt government to succeed, but also don't want to be Islamic terrorists, moderate Muslims, people who just want Syria to succeed. That door is still open, but it is closing. And President Obama is missing an opportunity. We can radiate the cancer now, or we can let it spread. And I don't want to hear someone arguing a year from now. I don't want to hear liberals saying, oh, well, you know, I guess we have to support the Islamic insurgency, even though it's infused with Al-Qaeda, because the government of Assad is so bad. And conservatives saying, well, I guess we have to support the evil Assad government because the Islamic insurgency is so bad. No, there is a choice. There's a difference. There is a third door. Syria happens to have a strong, educated middle class. These bombs are happening in Damascus. Call me Cassandra, but I can predict the future. I can see this coming, just as it happened in Latin America in the 1980s. Right? You had the liberals say we have to support the insurgents, even though they're supported by the Soviet Union and the communists. And you had the conservatives saying, no, we have to beat them down with these horrible dictatorships that are doing massacres in El Salvador and Guatemala. And they were both wrong. There is door number three. And in fact, Latin America has found it, thank God, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. They now have, almost all of them, democracies, some struggling, some quite successful, that are neither communist nor military corrupt dictatorships. The same is true in the Arab world. There is a third way between corrupt dictatorships, some supported by the United States, some supported by Iran, like Syria, and Islamic fundamentalist extremist terrorists, like Al-Qaeda, or for that matter, like some elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. If you heard my show last week, you know that the Syrians I talked to on the air, live, risking their life from Syria, they certainly talk a good game. What they say, if they are to be believed, and I'm going to deal with that in a second, but if they are to be believed, they talk about freedom and middle class and democracy, protection of religious minorities, which is so important, particularly in a country with as much ethnic diversity as Syria, where there is a significant Christian population. There is Shia and Sunni Muslim. They talk about religious freedom. You heard Majid, that's not his real name. If I gave his real name, he'd be more likely to be killed. I will not give his real name. But your people like Majid say, you know, Syria's been ruled by a Druze, which is a Muslim minority in the past. They've been ruled by a Christian in the past. It's not about the religion of the person in charge. It's about who's the best leader for Syria. Now, they talk a good game. What if they're lying? I mean, we have to face this, right? I can hear the people now. Mark, you're naive. You get a phone call from some fighter in Syria, and he tells you about the brutal atrocities that he has suffered in a prison camp. He told me, by the way, that he saw children talking to the UN monitors being shot. He saw people, and I'm sorry to be so graphic, but it's important to know what's going on. He saw people whose eyes were put out with spoons. Sorry. I don't know why that horrors makes me seems more horrific than actually just gunning down people, but it does. But what if he's lying to me? What if this is just, what if this is, look, he doesn't support Assad. What if all his stories about the brutalization are true? Because we know they're true because we've seen smuggled out pictures and videos. But what if this guy is secretly an Islamic fundamentalist who wants to impose Sharia law and persecute Christians and become like Al-Qaeda? It's possible. He doesn't talk it, but it's possible. Right? I mean, that's my fear in Libya and Egypt, let's face it, right? So I pressed him, if you heard the interview, I pressed him on these questions, and again, his answers were exactly what I wanted to hear, but maybe he's just telling me what I want to hear. Even so, even if that's true, okay, we're still better off supporting them, and I'll tell you why. If he goes into office, if he takes power, if he gets United States aid and makes explicit promises to them, just as he made to me, that freedom of religion will be protected in Syria, that they do not support violence against civilians. If they make those promises, and the United States aids Syria based on those promises, they can be held to those promises. Assad isn't making those promises, or the extent that he is, he's violating them right and left. Al-Qaeda ain't making those promises. Door number three may not be perfect, but it's the only other door we have. And door number three at least promises to do the right thing. And I happen to believe that if you aid a country like we aided in Syria, and they understand the United States will be on their side, or will be a brutal enemy, that it's far more likely that they're going to stay on our side. You start preaching democracy, and lo and behold, sometimes you start practicing it. And if they know that United States aid, like international development aid, Janessa's talking about, is dependent on freedom of religion and democratic principles, and they know that support from the United States, whether it be military or economic or trade or frankly legitimacy in the world community, depends on their practicing democracy and human rights and human freedoms, they might just do it. It's the best door we've got. It's the only door we've got, because door number one and door number two both lead you right off a cliff. Door number three is an unsteady bridge, but at least it's a bridge. And think about what it means for the United States in the future to be known as the country that supports human rights and democracy and religious freedom around the globe. That means something. You heard Janessa talk about, well, we can let China do it, promote the Chinese dream, but I'm an American, I want to promote the American dream. I couldn't agree more. So wake up, President Obama. I know you have to be reelected in November. But the world stage is calling, and it can't wait till November. I am very, very nervous about what's happening in Syria, and I'm very concerned that a year from now, it will be too late. So if you were willing, if you agree with me, if you don't, if you agree with me or not, I want to hear from you, 202-889-9797, whether you agree with me or not. But if you do agree with me, I would like it if you would call your member of Congress and let them know that you support action in Syria, that you understand that the Syrian people are fighting for their freedom, and that the United States can do something about it. We'll be right back after this.
Throw him in jail and they kept him there, hoping soon he'd die. Let his body and spirit were to waste away, and soon after that his mind. But every day he's born a fool. One who thinks.
15 restless riders, 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Welcome back to WEAC Radio, 1480 AM. If you want to call in, it's 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. So we've talked about Syria. We've talked about marriage equality. We've talked about the Arab Spring. A couple more topics before I go in the last 20 minutes. Again, I encourage you to call in if you want to. One is what's going on in Indiana. If you followed the Indiana primary, and a lot of people outside Indiana did not, but if you did, you saw that Richard Lugar, a senator who's been there since 1976, the longest-serving Republican senator, 36 years, was defeated in the Republican primary by a guy named Murdoch, a Tea Party guy. And the issue was whether one should ever compromise with the Democrats. Lugar, who has an 80% conservative rating, is the middle to right wing of the Republican Party, said that sometimes, occasionally, when the Democrats do something that cannot be done without bipartisan support, it's okay to work with Democrats. And Murdoch said, it's never okay to work with Democrats unless they entirely capitulate and agree with everything you say. In other words, Murdoch ran and won on the policy of no compromise, of gridlock. If you look at where the United States has been over the last 2 years, and I predicted this as soon as Republicans took over the House, on election night I said, we're going to be gridlock. Nothing's going to happen for 2 years. And there are people that don't want the government to do anything. They just simply want to go and dysfunction. Is that a verb? Dysfunction the government? Make it dysfunctional. So that it never works. And those people, I'm sure, were pleased and voted for Murdoch in Indiana. But don't ever complain that the government doesn't work when you voted for gridlock. Don't ever complain about bipartisanship being lacking, Republicans, when you vote for a man whose express campaign provision is, I will never compromise. You cannot have a party system where the Democrats are always compromising and the Republicans are never compromising, because when you do that, the Republicans always win. So the Democrats have to respond to this extremism by compromising less themselves, and then nothing gets done, and then all the problems of this country get unsolved, and then people get upset, and Congress has an approval rating of 9%. But don't blame the Democrats. Don't blame the Democrats. Don't claim this is a two-sided issue. Oh, both sides won't cooperate. No, the Democrats have bent over backwards to cooperate with the Republicans, and the Republicans say, screw you, I'm taking my ball, I'm going home. I want Obama to fail, Rush Limbaugh said. Even if it means the country failing. Okay, he didn't have those last words. I do. But that's what he meant. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, the highest ranking Republican in 08 or 09 or 2010, second highest ranking Republican right now, after Speaker Boehner. Mitch McConnell said, when asked what his first priority was in his Congress, was it, I don't know, solving health care issues or taxes or the deficit or war? Or, no, his first goal was making sure President Obama was a one-term president. He is devoting his life not to helping this country, not to making America a better place, not to helping kids go to college, not to providing health care, not even to cutting the deficit or helping the big corporations that are so much in his pocket. His first goal is to destroy the President of the United States and make him fail. I guess he's a Limbaugh fan. Well, if that's your goal, if you put your partisan priorities ahead of the United States, if you put your party ahead of country, then that leads the country to go downhill. Someone who was patriotic, someone who cared about America, someone who put their country first, as John McCain used to argue in 2008, would say, for the good of the country, let's try to make a deal. I don't always agree with the people on the other side of the aisle, but let's try to do what's best for the country. That is not your current Republican Party. And if you ever doubted it, just look at the Indiana primary. There must be some moderate Republicans out there. There must be a single Republican somewhere that cares more about their country than they do about the destruction of Barack Obama. Hey, if you're out there, give me a call, 202-889-9797. I hear from a few of you. But when you have a party that is going to take no prisoners, that is never going to compromise on anything, don't blame both parties. It's not both parties' fault. When we come back, I want to discuss the Volcker Rule. The idea that banks should not be able to gamble with taxpayer dollars. Remember what the Republicans want. They don't want your tax money going to student loans. They don't want your tax money going to health care or schools or roads or bridges or police officers or teachers. They want your tax money going to bailing out banks that make bad gambling habits. Pretty crazy, right? Hard to believe, right? Nope, that's what the Volcker Rule is all about. And we'll get to it when I come back. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. We got about 13 minutes left. I want to wish everyone a happy Mother's Day, all the mothers out there. And if you're not a mother, but you have a mother, please remember how lucky you are to have a mother living, or a grandmother, or a sister who's a great mother, or a cousin, or a friend, or a colleague. Please treat mothers special today. You know, when I think about mothers, I think about all the ways that children try them. And I think of kids who, I don't know, you ever had a kid that would like slam something shut and he'd try to pull his hand out just before the door shuts? It was a game and he would giggle and all, and mom would say, hey, you know, you're going to slam your hand there. And when you do, don't come crying to me. And the kid would slam the door and jump his hands out just in time and giggle and have such a great time. And then the inevitable happens. He slams the cabinet door. He doesn't get out in time. He bangs his finger, and immediately, Mommy! That, in essence, is what the banks want to do. They want to have their fun. They want to go and bet everything in Vegas, right? Put all of it on red, and you roll the roulette wheel, and red comes up, and you roll it again on black, and at this time black comes up, and all's well and good. But then the wheel spins, and you don't get your number, and you lose a lot. And then you cry, Mommy, government, please help me! I've just destroyed billions of dollars! That's what happened to J.P. Morgan this week. When its highly respected CEO, Jamie Dimon, the same guy who was arguing that we don't need Wall Street regulation, ate crow and had to admit that one of his traders, a guy who made trades so big they called him the London Whale, Bruno Ixel, one of their traders in London, had, oops, lost $2 billion. Oops. Whoops. You know how you misplace your wallet. You know how you drop $100 bills in the street. Maybe you don't do this. Some people do this. Well, Bruno just lost $2 billion. That's all. Oops. You can wreck a car. There goes $10,000, $20,000. An expensive car, $30,000. Well, Bruno wrecked the equivalent, this London Whale, of 30,000 cars. Oops. Whoops. Whoops. if you understand what put us in this crisis, you know it was precisely gambling by institutions that had a great system going. It worked really well. Heads we win, tails you lose. If the market goes the way we predict it will, we make oodles of money, hundreds of billions of dollars that we CEOs can use for our gold-plated toilet seats so we can live the life of Mitt Romney. And if we lose, we will take down the entire economy with us unless the government comes and bails us out and we still get the hundreds of billions of dollars for our golden toilet seats. We win either way. Paul Volcker is the ex-chairman of the Federal Reserve. Actually, one of the best. He was appointed by Jimmy Carter. He lasted and was reappointed under Ronald Reagan. There are not too many things that Carter and Reagan both agreed on. But Jimmy Carter, Paul Volcker got us out of the stagflation, the high inflation, high unemployment of the 1970s. He is the one, not Ronald Reagan, that gets credit for the pretty good economy in the 1980s. That was much better than the 1970s. Paul Volcker has a rule that bears his name. It's a real good one. And the rule says this. If you're going to go gambling, and you're going to take all the benefits if you win in the gamble, then you know what? Don't say if you lose, Mommy! Government! Come bail me out. As we say in the South, you knew it was a snake when you picked it up. And if it bites you, don't cry about it. But the problem with very, very large institutions like J.P. Morgan is that when they fail, everybody fails. What happened when AIG failed, when Lehman Brothers failed, is they took the entire world economy down with them. $2 billion is a canary in a coal mine. It's a rounding error to a company that has $200 billion like J.P. Morgan does. But Jamie Dimon, the CEO, was arguing that the implementation of the Volcker Rule, one of the best parts of the Dodd-Frank bill, the bill by Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, to make sure that our financial crisis never happens again, he was trying to weaken it. What the Volcker Rule says is really quite simple. If you're a bank and you get federally subsidized benefits, you know the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, you know how it is. You put money in the bank and you know that even if the bank fails, you get to keep your money. Terrific Depression era thing. That's great for you. But it's not good if the bank then makes bets on that money, knowing that if they win their bets, they make tons. And if they lose, the federal government will come bail them out. How much would you bet in Vegas if you knew that for every bet you won, you got to keep, and for every bet you lost, someone else had to pay? I would suggest that under that system, you would bet your heart out. And that's what banks have been doing on these very complex credit derivative swaps. So the London whale, Bruno Ixel, bet $100 billion. So he lost $2 billion. Yeah, on a $100 billion bet, $2 billion lost doesn't even seem that bad. Let this be a lesson. Let this be a lesson in the campaign. Mitt Romney believes in repeal of Dodd-Frank. He believes in repeal of financial reform. He believes that Wall Street banks should be able to gamble with taxpayer dollars again. He believes that we should have a system that leads to lots and lots of bank bailouts. He believes that rich people should be able to bet one way where they get richer, and if they get poor, and if they lose their bet, that we, the middle class, should save them again. Think about it. Mitt Romney places $250 million on the roulette wheel. If it turns out red, he doubles his money. If it turns out black, then he goes to the homeless man and says, pay my bet. Goes to the college student. I'm sorry you can't go to college today. You have to repay my bet. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't get health care. Your husband's going to have to die of cancer because I got to repay my bet. What the Volcker Rule does, what the Democrats have said, is that you cannot place these bets when you require the government to bail you out. And it's really not that hard to understand. As Volcker said when he testified before the Senate Banking Committee, quote, "It is surely inappropriate that activities be carried out by institutions for speculative bets that benefit from taxpayer support, current or potential. Bet your own damn money, big banks." And the best thing about this complete failure of JP Morgan, honestly, is that it's coming now before the regulations are out, because in back rooms, JP Morgan and other very large institutions were working very hard to weaken the Volcker rule, to make it really hard for banks to do these speculative bets. If they weaken something that makes it hard for them to do these things, it makes it easier, obviously, to do this kind of gambling. I think it's ridiculous that we're even having this discussion. We should have learned in the Great Depression that these things were a bad idea. We certainly should have learned in the second Great Depression, the Great Recession of 2007-2008, that this kind of gambling where banks bet the entire nation's economy, knowing heads they win, tails we all lose, and we pay for the banks, was a bad idea. It shouldn't require another $2 billion loss. Frankly, we should have seen this back in the 1990s. You may not even remember a guy, Nick Leasing, I think was his name. He was a trader at Barings Bank in Singapore. And he made some wrong bets and lost hundreds of billions of dollars. And this 150-year-old bank, maybe even older, 200-year-old bank, centuries-old bank in England, went bankrupt because one guy made one wrong trade. Listen up, big banks. Don't let London Wales exist. Don't let people make $100 billion trades. You know what? If you make a $100 billion trade, you better have $100 billion and be trading on your own account. Because if you're betting those large sums and you fail, you know the economy will collapse unless some government helps you. We've got to defend the Volcker rule. Thank you, J.P. Morgan, for losing $2 billion and not $200 billion and not $2 million, losing not enough to destroy the economy, but losing enough to wake everybody up and recognize that Mitt Romney would return our economy to exactly the same kind of moral hazard as existed in 2008, the exact same thing that brought us on with the Great Recession. That if you elect someone like Mitt Romney, someone who believes in government by the rich, of the rich, and for the rich, you're not only believing in his tax plan, which taxes middle class and poor and working people and everyone who makes under $1 million more so the millionaires make out like bandits, but someone who wants to allow millionaires to bet the farm, knowing if they lose it, we'll all pay them out. Enough with the bailouts. Enough with Mitt Romney. I certainly hope and pray this will be a huge issue in the upcoming campaign, and it better. It really better. Because if it does not, if we get Mitt Romney again, and we're headed for another great recession because some bank plays some bad bet, don't ever tell you I didn't tell you so. I'm telling you so right now. That's it for the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I hope that you will check out my website, marklevinetalk.com, where I will replay this show and all the other things I do on TV and otherwise. You can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk, and go to my Facebook page, the Mark Levine Fan Page, and let me know that you're listening and you like React Radio. I am here every Sunday from 11 to 3. I'm with Nancy Skinner from 11 to 1 and by myself from 1 to 3, and I'm always happy to have you listen in. So please tune in every Sunday to React Radio. From 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. for 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the afternoon for more of the Inside Scoop. And next up is Moms Rising with, I can't read Pete's handwriting, Kristen is up next. So Kristen and Moms Rising, you won't want to miss that show. For now, this is Mark Levine. I'm signing off. Happy Mother's Day, everybody.